In the name of Allah, the most gracious and the most merciful. First and foremost, I wanted to thank the MSA here for inviting me to this program. I'd like to also thank the audience for coming and listening to the topic that we have for today, which is Islam's contribution to humanity. I remember I was getting on the plane a few months ago, I think about last June or something like that. And as you know, you go through the... You want me to speak closer? Okay. And they always make sure to tell you to have your ID out when you are going through a security check, right? Have your ID out, have your ticket out. But then when you're going through the metal detector, you don't need your ID. You just need to show them the ticket. So as I was looking at the line in front of me, I was getting my laptop out, everything, and behold, when it's my turn, this TSA officer greets me and he reads my ticket out loud. So he looks at my first name, so he's like, Abdul Rahman Chao. Wait, Chao. Is that right? I said, no. He said, you mean like Chao? I said, exactly. He's like, Dog Chao. I said, yes, just like Dog Chao. And so, for those people that might have fought, in fact, I noticed some people here, they didn't know that I was a speaker. And you might have been expecting some Arab, you know, coming in, right, with a turban. And perhaps, you know, my presence here probably breaks some of that kind of an assumption. So, with that said, since now I have broken your assumption, you can take all of your other assumptions or previous information or misconceptions about Islam, and I will direct you to the two garbage cans right here, one right here, one right here. So we want to have a very clear understanding. We are in an academic setting. We want to have a very clear understanding about what Islam is. We would like to share with you something that is great, something that is marvelous. And the only reason I'm standing up here today is because I humbly believe that what I believe in and my principles as based on Islam is something that I would like all of you to have, Muslim or non-Muslim. And when we hear about the word Middle East, right? When we are growing up, when we hear the word Middle East, right? We like to see that, right? The Alibaba and the, you know, the thieves, and that, and always that spooky music, right? We always have that kind of stuff, right? You know, the genie inside the lamp, etc. This is what we think about when we hear about the Middle East, right? Also, if I were to say to you, let's say, Arab, Islam, Saudi Arabia, Muhammad, right? I assume you might think of this. Women clad in black clothing, right? Burqa. And the beautiful desert sun setting right there with about 5 camels, right? And so this is probably what pops into your head. And this is not something strange, for Islam indeed is something that came as something strange to the people, as one of the quotations of Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He says Islam came as something that was strange to the people, and it will go back as something strange. Now, if I were to say to you, Islamic civilization, right? You will think about great mosques. You will think about buildings, the Ottoman Empire, right? You will think about Baghdad and all these great cities that were built throughout the Islamic history, right? But this is not what I want you to think about. This is not what this is not the objective. We want to remove the images of the genie lamp that you have to rub. We want to remove the images of the camels in the desert with the sunset. And we hope that with this lecture, you will be able to have a new understanding. It will enable all of us to have a new page in how we perceive Islam to be. The topic that we have today, as you saw at the first slide, is Islam's contribution to humanity. Now, we can understand this statement in two different ways. We can understand this statement, Islam's contribution to humanity, in two different ways. Number one, it could be Islam as a religion. What did it contribute to humanity? What can it contribute to humanity? Or number two, what have Muslims contributed to humanity? What have people contributed to humanity who also happen to be Muslims? But before we want to engage this word, the topic, we need to understand this word humanity. For the word humanity is based, you know, it's more or less based upon civilization itself. And so what is civilization then, right? What is civilization? We have here Jane Addams, right? You might know of her. She was a women's rights activist, right? She was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, founder of the U.S. Settlement House movement. This movement that she did was mainly providing food, shelter to the needy people by virtue of the wealthy of that society. And she gave this definition. She said, civilization is a method of living. Or you could say, civilization is a complex society that is financially self-sufficient to one way or another and governed by an intricate social hierarchy. In ancient times, you will find that each tribe, each group of people, they had set roles defined for men and women. Closer?
Yeah.
Okay. He doesn't want to move. I feel like an immigration officer. He's evicting him from his stand. So who can tell me here, in ancient times, what was the role of men? You can just shout it out. It's all good. I'm sorry?
Hunters.
Hunters. Indeed. What else? They hunt and? They were food gatherers. For food. What else?
Protect.
Exactly. That was their job. They were there to protect the people. As for women in old days, what were their roles?
Raising the children.
Making sure the upkeep of the tents or the whatever dwelling is good, nice shape, right? Cooking. And this was the role that they had then. And of course, the role of man and women in today's society is always changing. And I'm not asking the women here to check on the pot roast in the oven. Neither am I asking the man to look at the final facts and check on his next appointment. And the question is, what exactly is your role, right? What is the role that you play in this world? That is a question that every single one of us need to think about. Islam asks every single person to think about what can they do to humanity. As they always say, either you bring something new, you bring something additional to this world, or you are just an addition to the world. And so if you are to look at your surroundings, right? If you are to look at your surroundings, you will come to realize that man, no matter how powerful they are, right? And I chose this wooden figurine or this mannequin right here is because this thing is very weak. You can bend it like this and bend it like that. Men, humankind is very weak in reality. We get sick and that's it. We're on the bed for like 3 days. When we get old, we probably cannot even control our own hand movements. And so when a person comes to realize that there is something greater than himself, that there is a power beyond his own power. And so when they realize that the footprints in the desert indicate the passing of an animal or the passing of some traveler, or when they see that there are droppings in the forest, they know that animals were here, then a person will come to the realization that there is a higher being up there. This is what Islam asks everyone to look at. What is your role? Of course, we as Muslims, we believe that every single human being on earth, their role is to what? Is to worship the one only God. Everything else, such as getting money, getting married, getting a job, all of these things, they are secondary. However, Islam asks everyone to look at their surroundings. Look at the heavens, look at the earth. Look at, especially if you, how many of you here study biology? Exactly. Now, if you are a doctor, you study biology, you study chemistry, there is no way that a person can actually say that all of these things happen by itself. Okay? It's not possible. I mean, especially if you look at, for example, the human ear, right? I mean, you just look at the inner ear itself. There's the cochlea, right? Inside, there's like all these little hairs, and there's like a liquid, and there's also like some little microscopic small rocks on top, right? And so when you move your head, these rocks are shifting, so you know your direction is moving. When you are sitting on a chair when you were 12 and spinning on that computer chair, when you open your eyes and you are so dizzy, why is there the dizziness? Because the liquid inside that cochlea is still spinning away. Who designed all of this? How is it possible that the eagle or the falcon that is up like, I don't know, 1,000 feet in the air flying around has one pair of limbs, and then when it's about to go and get the fish or the trout, it will switch to another pair of limbs? All of these things point to a greater power. So when a person realizes that there is a greater power out there, then the answer should be that they should submit to this greater power. Okay? And so this is what we call the beginning of the foundation of Islamic civilization. The beginning of the foundation of Islamic civilization. Okay? So the first foundation that we have is religion and spirituality. When you realize that you are feeble in front of this Creator, you will do everything to seek its help. You will do everything to safeguard your life, your property, your wealth, your thoughts. And so that is why Islam, this word, is commonly mistranslated as peace. It doesn't mean peace. Islam means submission. Because you have now realized you are weak in front of this greater being. So a Muslim is the one that submits to God's will, submits to His laws and regulations. So the role that we have on this earth, as Islam says, is to worship God Almighty. So you might have heard of that phrase before, Allahu Akbar, right? A lot of people, they translate it as God is great. This is actually not correct. The correct translation for Allahu Akbar is God is greater. Because if you were to say God is the greatest, it would have been Allahu Al-Akbar. Allah is the greatest. So Allahu Akbar, God is greater, you can plug in any word you want after that. So if someone makes his life his objective to seek money, then we will say God is greater than seeking money. If someone's objective is
to attain power, then we say God is greater than seeking power. If someone's job or their desire and their dream is to gain fame, then we will say God is greater than that fame itself. So in general, without going on too long, for Muslims, we all believe that the bedrock of this religion and spirituality is built upon five pillars. Okay? There are five pillars that support this thing. So we believe you have to believe in God. You have to, the testimony of faith, believing that God is God, believing that Muhammad is the final prophet. Number two, establishing the prayers, the five daily prayers. Giving alms, giving zakah to the poor people. Also, siyam, fasting. Muslims fast 30 days in a year, from sunrise to sunset, abstaining from food, drink, and relations with the spouse. And also, finally, al-hajj, pilgrimage to Mecca. I want all of you to keep these five things in mind. The testimony of faith, the prayer, alms, fasting, and hajj. So, for example, when a Muslim is praying five times a day, this is a renewal. See, this is the clear difference between Islam and many other religions. Islam reminds a person to humble themselves five times a day. So if you look at the times of the prayer, you have one in the sun or before the sunrise, you have one in the noontime, you have one in the afternoon, one in the evening, the sunset time, which we're going to pray right afterwards, inshallah, God willing, and then we have one in the evening. If you look at this, this itself is the essence of civilization. Because when a civilization knows how to manage its time and knows how to use its resources, this is a successful civilization. Okay? And so, Islam is not only about taking natural resources and benefiting out of it. Herodotus said, Egypt is the gift of the Nile. Okay? How? Because they utilized the Nile and they were able to build such a huge empire out of it. Islam says, not just that. Not only do you need resources to build a civilization, you need to know how to manage the time. You need to know how to manage the relationship between yourself and God. Skipping along, these are a few essentials of spirituality. Okay? These are a few essentials. So if you want to say that you submit to God or you are a believer in God and you worship Him, you need to first have knowledge of this God. I met someone of one particular faith one time, and he said to me that he worships so-and-so, or he worships this one God that he has. So I asked him, I said, what does he do for you? Telling you, after he told me that he has many different gods, I said to him, what is it exactly that this God does for you? Because he had like one he worships on one day, then he worships another one another day. I said, what is exactly does this God do for you? He said, you know, I really don't know. It's just, I worship him, that's it. So if you think about this answer itself, if a person doesn't even know why they are submitting, if they don't even have knowledge as to why they are submitting to this higher being, then this faith that they have is very shaky. Anyone can come and give them, you know, some doubt, and their faith will be shaken. Going along, you must be certain. You must be certain that this thing that you believe in, this higher being, is there. It cannot be like, maybe God's there, maybe God's not there, maybe God existed once, and then maybe God disappeared, right? If you have, you must have certainty. Also, once you are certain that God is the one that is worthy to be worshipped, this is when you submit to Him. This is actually showing your true faith in Him. You submit to Him. And when you submit, you accept whatever commandments are there. And when you accept these things, you will come to love. And then you also have to be truthful when you say that you believe in God. For the one that is not truthful is like the hypocrite that says that he believes in God but is not indeed a believer. And finally, you have to be sincere. Now, there are some things in religion, every single religion, sometimes we might not understand. You might find someone saying, why is it that you have to do this, and why is it that you cannot do that? I mean, that probably comes up. Why is it that this is okay? Why is it that that's not okay? And there are, we want to address this very quickly, which is that there are some things that in Islam, God has told us the wisdom behind it. And in some things, God did not tell us about the wisdom behind it. And you might say, why didn't God tell us the reason behind it? What's the wisdom behind it? Let me give you an example. You tell a kid, when you go to the supermarket, stay next to me and don't saunter off and traipse into and hide into the racks of the clothes. Now that five-year-old, do you think that five-year-old understands what is Amber Alert? I don't think any child understands what's Amber Alert. But yet at the same time, you do not need the child to understand what is the danger of child kidnappers. You don't need them to realize that, oh, you know, someone might take you away and, you know, make it take advantage of you and sell you off somewhere and do something evil to you. But the child doesn't need to know that. And so sometimes there are some things in Islam, not all, there are some things God did not tell us why. Because we realize that our minds, our brain is not the most powerful. There are so many things today that scientists cannot explain. Why is it? And so we attribute this infinite knowledge to God Himself. Moving along. After a person realizes that and polishes the relationship between themselves and God, this is where the second foundation comes along, which is morals and ethics. You have polished your spirit, so now you need to polish your action. There's a statement of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in which he says, "La yu'minu ahadukum hatta yuhibba li akhihi ma yuhibbu li nafsihi." None of you have truly believed until you love for your brother what you love for yourself. And I want all of you to think about how deep the statement is. So back to the five pillars that we said about giving alms to the poor people, right? Giving alms. So as you can see, everything in Islam is built from bottom up. So a person believes that he has to give alms because God said so. Why? Well, God said so. But there's a reason why God said so. Why? Because you believe that this characteristic, generosity, is what will purify your heart. This is what is going to benefit the society. This is what's going to benefit your own behavior, so you don't become stingy. So you are generous. So it cleanses you spiritually and cleanses your money. We believe that the zakah actually, giving alms will actually purify your money. Similarly, Islam did not come to remove all the other good things out there in the universe. Islam came to perfect it. And we'll talk about that. So if you truly love for your brother what you love for yourself, then you will not deceive him, you will not cheat, you will not backbite him, you will not do terrible things to him. One time, the Prophet, peace be upon him, he was walking with his companions, and so there was one person that had done something. So one of them said, "You know what? That person is like this," or something like that. So the Prophet didn't say anything, and so they were walking, and they continued walking and going until they passed by a dead donkey. It was a carcass, it was rotting. So the Prophet dismounted, he got off his camel or his horse, and then he told that person, he said, "Go and eat that thing." So that companion, he said, "Messenger of God, how is it that I can eat this dead carcass?" He said, "Well, you did backbite your brother." And that is why in the Holy Quran, God describes backbiting as what? To eat your brother's dead flesh. Why? Because they are not able to defend themselves. Just like if you're to eat them when they're dead, there's no way to defend themselves. So if a Muslim truly loves for their brother what he loves for himself, he would not backbite them. In another narration, the Prophet said, "إِنَّمَا بُعِثُ لِأُتَمِّمَ مَكَارِمَ الْأَخْلَاقِ." I have been sent to you so that I can perfect the best of morals and manners. So honesty, truthfulness, generosity, all of these things are universal. It is not only to like the ancient Egyptian civilization or the ancient Romans. No, these are universal values. Islam came to strengthen this thing too. And that is why Islam talks about treating others with forgiveness, patience, and kindness. And here's a good story I want to share with you. There was this one imam in the past, his name was Ja'far al-Sadiq. Okay. Ja'far al-Sadiq one time was washing himself. He was making ablution, like it's a ritual washing of the limbs, you know, the arms, the feet, wiping of the face, washing of the face, etc. So he can pray to God. So his servant had a jug of water next to him, so he was pouring it for Ja'far al-Sadiq. So as he was pouring it, he kind of splashed some water onto Ja'far al-Sadiq. So Ja'far al-Sadiq looked at him, just, you know, gave him a look. Immediately, his servant recited the verse of God. In the Quran it says, وَالْكَاظِمِينَ الْغَيْظِ, and those that suppress their anger. And so Ja'far al-Sadiq, he's not like, who do you think you are? Who's your daddy to come and teach me about Islamic morals, huh? I'm your master, you shut it. Give me a towel. No. What did he say? He said, I have indeed suppressed my anger. And then the servant, naturally he finished the second part of the verse. He says, وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ, and the ones that forgive the people. So Ja'far al-Sadiq said, قَدْ عَفَوْتُ عَنْكَ, I have forgiven you. And naturally he completed the rest of the ayah, وَاللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الْمُحْسِنِينَ, and Allah loves the good doers. And so Ja'far al-Sadiq, he says, you are free, and here is 1,000 coins you can take from the money, you are free now. Likewise, treatment of parents. Unfortunately, we are living in a society now where some people, they put their parents in what you call, I don't call it retirement homes. They don't really retire there, okay? It's just to keep their parents away from them so they don't bother them. Islam highly, highly advocates the good treatment of parents. As the Prophet ﷺ, he was one time asked by a man who wanted to go and participate in an expedition. So he said to him, you cannot go. You have to go and tend to your parents. For paradise lies beneath the feet of the mother. Similarly, if you're going to polish your spiritual morals, you also have to polish your physical body itself. Benjamin Disraeli, right, this English man, he one time said a beautiful quote I want to share with you. Cleanliness and order are not matters of instinct. They are matters of education, and like most great things, you must cultivate a taste for them. Islam came about 1500 years ago. 1500 years ago, most of the people in Europe and other parts of the world did not have the concept of taking showers once a day. If they took a shower once a year, that was considered to be a great blessing and a miracle in and of itself. And if they did take a shower, it would involve light dipping of the body into heavily scented bathtubs. And this is what they thought cleanliness was. They were afraid, they were actually a little bit paranoid. They thought that if you took a bath, you could get sick. 1500 years ago, Islam made it obligatory for everyone to take a shower at least once a week. You have to take a shower. It didn't say that's the minimum. It didn't say that's the maximum. It said that is the minimum. You have to at least take a shower once a week. Likewise, before you, every Muslim is supposed to perform, and you have to understand that people are living in the desert. Water is scarce. So the Prophet ﷺ said, if you don't have the water, I mean, if you probably don't have the water with you all the time to take a shower, it's a luxury to take a shower. So what do? You perform the wudu before every salah. Why do we wash the face, the limbs, the feet? Because these are the things that get dirty the fastest. These are the things that get dirty the fastest, so that's why Muslims are required to wash their face, wipe their head, wash their hands up to the elbows, and their feet. Look back at the other thing that we said about fasting, right? We said that one of the pillars of Islam is to fast 30 days in a year. How does it link to the second foundation of Islam, which is morals and behavior? Well, We talked about, right, just a little bit before, about giving charity to the poor people. When a multimillionaire or multibillionaire gives charity out to the poor person, they really, really never know what it feels like to be poor. So when you actually fast and refrain from food and drink for 30 days, you are actually polishing your own behavior. You are really understanding what does it feel like for the less fortunate to fast. And you can also do some research. For example, in 1994, the first International Congress on Health and Ramadan was held in Casablanca, Morocco, Maghrib. They talked about, and over 50 doctors, they had this the paper that they signed talking about the health benefits of fasting. And then you can read up about that. Fasting is not something that is only in Islam. If you look in the Bible, you look in the Old Testament, the previous religions, they used to also fast. Finally, we have the last thing. After you have polished your morals, and you have polished your behavior, and you have polished your ethics, it is now time to benefit the society. For you cannot claim, and when we say the word society, it means anything other than these two. Getting money, education, politics, social reform, freedom, liberty, all of these things. You cannot say, I'm going to pursue a job which will be at the expense of the bottom two. Islam doesn't allow that. So if someone, so the whole concept of Robin Hood, stealing from the rich, giving to the poor, this is not accepted in Islam. Because, you know, you need to give to the poor, true. But if you are infringing on the commandment, the first command which is do not, or the commandment in the Quran, do not steal, then you're not going to get rewarded for helping the society. Because you are hurting the bottom level. And so that is why I hope by now you will have realized that Islamic civilization, if you look it up in Wikipedia, it's just going to tell you, okay, the Arabs came out of the desert, this is what happened, and then they had the Prophet time, the Caliphate time, Umayyad, Abbasid, Uthmaniyun, the Mamalik, and in between, okay, all of these different dynasties, and then boom, and then the splitting of the Ottoman Empire into these countries now. But by now, I think you might have understood, by now, that with this chart in front of us, Islamic civilization is not bound by a land, by a time, by a group of people. You could be living in the middle of a jungle. You could be living in some glacier. You could be living in an igloo. You could be living in some other part of the world, and you can still establish Islamic civilization as long as you follow these three things. Another example of how Islam can benefit society is that when you fast, right, not only do you feel their hunger, but it actually brings the brotherhood together. Because Muslims are required to break their fast at the mosque, or not required, but this is recommended, to break their fast together as a communal level. And how does this help? It makes the brotherhood come close. Likewise, Islam codified the art of war. Do not cut trees down. Do not burn fields. Do not kill women. Do not kill children. Do not attack houses of worship. Do not do all of these things. But all of these rules were there 1,400 years ago. Way before the Magna Carta was written. And this is something that, you know, I want all of you to think about. CNN, they were talking about with Barack Obama's time now as being President of the United States, the first African American. He has made history, right? They were talking about, has this election brought racial equality to the United States of America? And they were doing a research, you can look it up on CNN, they said it has not brought much of a difference. There is still racism in the United States of America. Slavery has been outlawed so long. But we have people that are bigots that wish to treat African American, whatever, on a different level. And this is not just only to the African American. You find now after September 11, there were people that might have looked like Middle Eastern, right? They might have looked like it. And they would just accuse them of some crime. And is this racial equality? One time a man came to the Prophet, he was a black man, Bilal bin Rabah, right? Just like the name of our speaker here. Moderator or MC. So Bilal bin Rabah was from Abyssinia. So one time he got into an altercation or verbal altercation with someone. So what did he say? So that man said to him, "Ya ibn Umm Sauda, oh you son of the black woman. Oh you son of the black woman. How offensive." So he went to the Prophet and the Prophet Muhammad, he complained to him. And the Prophet told him, "You have ignorance inside of you. Islam does not allow racial discrimination. It is out. You cannot be Muslim and then hating on another race. This is not acceptable. For the Prophet said, there is no white man better than a black man. And no black man better than a white man. There is no Arab better than a non-Arab. And there is no non-Arab better than an Arab." And so, this is just a very simple approach that I have brought together, or this effort that I've brought, to share with all of you regarding what Islamic civilization is. Now, we want to go to the next section, which is what the Muslims that have lived in the past generations, what have they brought forth to humanity? And this is just very briefly, we want to go over it. Okay, so we have all the numbers. Okay. So you can see number 14, 15, number 17, you can just peruse, scrutinize. 14, 15, Aristotle, Plato, and you also have Plotinus in number 17. There's probably some difference of opinion among the scholars, if it's really him. And you also have number 5, it's right here on the side, this Arab-looking person with a turban, like bending his head like this, right? So Aristotle, Plato, this other person, and you also have Averroes, which is Ibn Averroes. You have this person right here. And what did these Arabs do? When the Greeks, when the Romans, they had their philosophy, the Arabs took their philosophy and they translated it into their languages. Syriac, Arabic, etc., Aramaic, etc. When those books were lost, Arab Muslims, they took these books again and they retranslated them into Latin. If Arab Muslims did not translate them back into Latin, the West would not have benefited from all these different ideologies that they have, such as democracy and all of these other ideas. Due to the way how the language was moving, Arabic going to Latin, etc., the translation of these books caused a lot of Arabic words being fused into the European languages. So, for example, apricot is originally an Arabic word. Magazine is an Arabic word. Makhazin means a storage warehouse of much things. So magazine is a thing that stores a lot of information. It's metaphorical. Giraffe, zarafa, amalgamation, or amalgam. You also have mafia. Yeah. I think the Italians should pay tribute. Every time they make a new mafia group, they should, pay like $1 million, for using that name. Mattress, right? Have a good night's sleep on us. Right? Mattress discounters. Right? Mattress. No one knows that mattress is an Arabic word. It's originally matrah. It's something that you throw on the ground and you can sleep on it. Right? Artichoke. Artichoke, believe it or not, in Arabic, it really is artishoka. It means the thorn that grows on the ground. And that's what an artichoke literally looks like. There's so many other words, admiral, adobe, all of these other things. And so this is just, admiral is like Amir al-Bahar, means the commander of the ocean, etc. And so this is just a little example of how Arabic has influenced your everyday life. Who are these two old geezers? So we have on the left here, Fadil al-Tabib, okay, His Eminence, the doctor, al-Haytham. Okay. Now al-Haytham is the first person that wrote extensively about optics. A lot of people they attribute this to Newton. They say, "Oh, Newton did this," but actually, in reality, Newton benefited a lot from this person on the left, al-Haytham. And And Haytham was the first one to discover that light was to travel in a single line, and at the same time, he's one to discover that the spectrum of the different colors, etc. Ibn Sina, as we have right here, the guy on the right, right? This person, his name was Avicenna, right? This person was not only a great philosopher, also his book on the canon of medicine is considered to be the foundation that is actually heavily relied upon until today. And this word canon is originally an Arabic word, is qanun. Okay, it means the law itself. Also, we have Ibn Nafis of Syria, who was the first to discover and write extensively about the human pulmonary system, etc. This is way before the Europeans even came to realize that there was like arteries, etc., all these things. Anesthesia, for example, was used by Muslims hundreds and hundreds of years ago before it was performed in Europe. Also, technology. Muslims were the first to invent steam distillation, colored stained glass, which is now being used in all the Catholic and Christian churches, kerosene, tar to pave the streets, for example, hang gliders. You know, they say like, Amelia Hart and these people, right? The brothers, right? They were the flu. But the first people to actually know how to have a thing you can control and fly around with the hang glider was actually made by Muslims. Also, astrolabe, sextants, thermometers, all of these things were contributed to humanity by Muslim scholars. Also, this whole thing, we're in a university right now. You have baccalaureus, or you have in French the science, right? You also have masters, doctorate. This whole system was brought forth by by Muslims. For the oldest university on earth was in, or is still in Morocco, Al-Qarawiyyin. This is the first university. It is so old. This whole idea that you have in the university, chair of a department, this is actually based upon the idea of the scholar that used to sit inside the mosque, and he used to have the students sit around him. And so the students that were sitting around this sheikh were his talamid, his students. So it became known in today's world education as what? Fellows. Also, this whole thing about ijazah. What is ijazah? Ijazah in Islam is a certificate that the teacher gives to the next to his student to certify that he is indeed qualified to teach the sciences that he has learned from me, and that he's allowed to disseminate this knowledge. This whole idea culminated into what we have today in your school now, and all schools around the world, a bachelor's. Just think of the word ijazah in fiqh, which is actually a law degree in Islam for someone to give out legal rulings. Also, the issue of business partnerships, bills of trade, long-distance trade, capital accumulation, merchant capitalism, all of these things, surprisingly, were invented by the Abbasids when they used to trade extensively with the Europeans, etc. In conclusion, we have taken a walk through Islam and what it offers to humanity as a religion, and we have also looked at what Muslims have brought forth to to mankind itself. And so I would like to conclude and say, what does Islam truly offer? To sum it up, Islam provides inspiration from God so that we will all submit to Him and be liberated from all other falsehoods through continuous application with moderation. This is what Islam calls forward to. This is what I want everyone here to understand, and I hope that you will all have now grasped to some extent about what Islam has brought forth to mankind. For we could even forget about the scientific achievements. For what is important is, what does Islam as a religion bring to the society, bring to yourself spiritually, and to the whole world? And with this, I again thank the MSA for inviting me here, and I would like to conclude. And again, I thank all of you for listening to me. Thank you.